The state parole board is urged to set convicted murderer Barry Beach free. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry takes us to a special art class, and in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with journalist and history buff Kim Brigeman about the history of the Mullen Road. People from across Montana are telling the state parole board that convicted murderer Barry Beach deserves another chance at freedom. The Montana Board of Pardons and Parole reviewed Beach's clemency application and heard from a crowd of about 60 people in a two-hour hearing yesterday in Deer Lodge. Beach was convicted in 1984 at age 17 in the beating death of a classmate, Kim Neese. Board members heard from people who housed, employed, and befriended Beach when a judge released him for 18 months in 2011. They said Beach is no threat and would be an asset to the community. Beach was not in attendance. If the board accepts Beach's application, they will order an investigation for a clemency hearing. If not, Beach's 100-year prison sentence will stand.
And in other news from around the state, a Missoula man charged in the shooting death of a 17-year-old exchange student in his garage is receiving death threats and is afraid to leave his home, according to his attorney. Marcus Karma was released from jail yesterday after posting a $30,000 bond on a charge of deliberate homicide in the death of Deren Didi of Hamburg, Germany. Since then, his attorney Paul Ryan says Karma, his partner Janelle Flager, and their 10-month-old baby won't leave their Missoula home after receiving the threats. Karma is a wildland firefighter for the U.S. Forest Service who moved to Missoula a few months ago. The shooting has reignited debate over a state law that gives a person the right to protect his or her home from a threat, commonly known as the Castle Doctrine. State Democratic Representative Ellie Hill proposes changing the law, which she says goes too far and creates vigilante justice.
An August trial date has been set for a state senator charged with assaulting his young daughter, his estranged wife, and her boyfriend. Officials in the Carbon County Clerk of Court's office tell the Billings Gazette that the trial for Senator Jason Priest is scheduled to start on August 12. Priest was arrested on February 1 after a disturbance outside his house. Prosecutors say he threw his 4-year-old daughter through a doorway, tried to push his estranged wife down the stairs, tackled her boyfriend, and struggled with an officer who intervened. Priest pleaded not guilty on February 20th in Red Lodge to felony assault on a minor and misdemeanor counts of partner or family member assault, and resisting arrest. He remains free on a $1,500 bond.
The University of Montana is already implementing much of what the Obama administration recommends campuses do to reduce sexual assaults, according to campus spokeswoman Peggy Kaur. A White House task force recommended in a report released today that campuses identify and train victims advocates, develop training programs for school officers, and conduct surveys to gauge the frequency of sexual assault. In the wake of several sexual assault allegations and investigations, UM had previously reached an agreement with the Federal Department of Justice to improve its prevention and response efforts, and Kaur says they've done just that.
And that would include the online mandatory tutorial for all students about campus sexual assault and resources and bystander intervention. That would include training for employees on discrimination and what to do if someone comes your way and wants to report an assault or some other issue. It includes also campus climate surveys. We have begun working on and conducting our first campus survey in recent years, and that was handled over the fall, and we're accumulating data now.
Statistics show 1 in 5 female students is assaulted on campuses across the nation. Kaur believes the new push by the Obama administration can only help bolster UM's efforts to reduce those assaults.
Because it serves as a reminder, I think, to everyone that this is a serious issue in communities and in universities across the country, that the work on this issue is never done, and that we all have a responsibility to step forward and do what we can, both as individuals and as institutions, to stop this problem.
The federal government has also created a new website, notalone.gov, to post enforcement actions and help victims get local help and information about filing a complaint.
State data shows that 1 billion barrels of oil have been produced in the rich Bakken Shale Formation in western North Dakota and eastern Montana. Drillers first targeted the Bakken in Montana in 2000 and moved into North Dakota about 5 years later using advanced horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing techniques. Data shows that North Dakota has tallied 852 million barrels of Bakken crude, and Montana has produced about 151 million barrels. The Bakken encompasses some 25,000 square miles in North Dakota, Montana, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. About two-thirds of the acreage is in western North Dakota. Oklahoma-based Continental Resources is the biggest leaseholder in the Bakken. The company says two-thirds of the production from the Bakken has come in the past 3 years.
Longtime University of Montana journalism instructor Printer Bowler has died after a long illness. Bowler grew up in Scobey, Montana, where his grandfather started the local Daniels County Leader newspaper. Both Bowler's father and grandfather are in the Montana Newspaper Hall of Fame. After graduating from the University of Montana School of Journalism, Bowler served in the Vietnam War, and after the war worked for the San Francisco Bay Guardian. UM journalism professor Dennis Zweibold says Bowler led a varied life.
He'd been an author and a journalist, of course, but he'd also been a concert promoter in San Francisco in the counterculture heydays of the late 60s. He'd been a baker. He'd been a house painter. He was famous as a golfer and a philosopher about golf, too. So he'd done a little bit of everything, including teach for us for a long time.
Bowler wrote a book titled The Cosmic Laws of Golf and Everything Else, and also wrote poetry. Zweibold says Bowler's life experiences and commitment to good journalism made him a popular teacher.
I love to go into his classroom after his classes and see what piece of wisdom or quotation he'd written on the board. He taught a class for us in publication design, but it was always more than that. It was publication design and philosophy, and I think the students loved him for that.
Bowler was 72 years old.
High school art students from around the state converge on one town each year for a 24-hour workshop blitz. This year, Kalispell's Glacier High and Flathead Valley Community College house more than 200 students learning jewelry making, painting, printmaking, and numerous other techniques. Flathead reporter Ketchum Fry has more from the FVCC ceramic studio where students work on wheel throwing.
So if you keep your rim centered, the rest of it tends to follow.
Artist and ceramics professor David Regan gives tips to students as they practice wheel throwing.
When you first start the process, you throw the lump of clay down on the wheel so that it sticks.
The students sit bent over a flat wheel they spin by tapping their foot on a pedal, similar to running a sewing machine. They can speed up or slow down the wheel's spin by pressing on the pedal. Their clay-covered hands gently smooth and press the clay as it spins under their touch, adding pressure to smooth it into different shapes, occasionally dipping their fingers into cups of water to keep the clay moist and malleable.
Today's goal is to throw the tallest cylinder that they can using 2 pounds of clay. So it's kind of a good way to learn how to throw, because a cylinder is the basic shape where everything else is made from. So that you can make a bowl or a plate or a vase if you know how to make a cylinder.
Senior Callie Hunt from Florence has 3 completed cylinders now off the wheel, and she's contemplating the next step. One is tall, smooth, and narrow, vase-like. The other 2 are also tall and narrow, but with curves.
Because I'm not sure exactly if I want to just keep it so it's just, like, make it tall, make it really tall, or if I want to do what he suggested and, like, flip on its side, so it's kind of like you're like stacking different things on top of each other instead of like less vase shaped and more like abstract.
Regan is teaching tile mold making and beginning wheel throwing classes as part of the 2014 Montana Art Interscholastic event. Other workshops Hunt's involved in this year include learning to make forged bracelets, silk marbling, and urban art.
So we looked at a lot of street art, like we got to see like Banksy and Shepherd Fairey's work and stuff, and develop our own like tag. Like, it's not encouraging us to go out and tag stuff, but like developing your own like signature and like the little like embellishments that mean things to you.
Hunt has participated in this workshop weekend each year of her high school career.
We got into Butte, Great Falls. We had it at Florence 2 years ago, which was really nice. And then this is my last year, which is sad.
Are you interested in doing art in the future?
Yes. I want to st- study it in college, maybe not as a major, but if I could minor in it, I'd really like to minor in ceramics.
Hunt's art teacher, Amy York, says their school does have a wheel, so that isn't necessarily new to her students, but many other techniques are. She says coming to this weekend offers the students the opportunity to see new techniques, new equipment, and often get a glimpse of the collegiate and career paths in art.
So not only are they exposed to probably facilities and types of art making that their hometown schools may or may not be able to provide for them, but they're also working with a local artist. So they get to see the artist's work and get instruction from a different art teacher. Lots of little schools like mine, I'm the only person that they get instruction from for 4 years.
This year, more than 200 students participated from 18 different schools. York says each student brings in a piece of their own art.
And there's kind of like a pop-up art show. So they get to view other kids' art from all across the state in person. And Jennifer Combe, who teaches art education at the University of Montana, she brings her pre-service art educators with her. So people who are studying to be art teachers, and they come and they lead critiques on all the work.
York says for herself it's also a good chance to catch up with other art teachers, hear what they're doing, and share what's happening in her classroom.
I know my students look forward to it. They start talking about it the first week of school in art club every year. We fundraise all year to come, and a lot of kids say it's the best weekend of their whole high school art career. You know, I brought 17 kids from Florence, and only two of them haven't been before. So it's a tradition that all the schools keep going.
In the ceramic studio, it's time to clean up and head off to the next workshop. Each one lasts an hour and 45 minutes. Hunt has decided to go a little abstract with her cylinders, stacking one on top of another, perpendicular to the one below it. In addition to Glacier High and Florence, there were students from Alberton, Butte, Charlie M. Russell, Columbia Falls, Flathead, Great Falls, Hellgate, Jefferson, Lincoln County High School, Paris Gibson Education Center, Shelby, Sheridan, Superior, and Troy. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Lots of us are familiar with the Mullen Road, the road that traverses the expanse from Walla Walla, Washington to Fort Benton, Montana. Missoulians, for instance, routinely use Mullen to access their homes or shopping or dining on Reserve Street. The Missoula County Detention Center is located there as well. But perhaps you've never given a second thought to the road's namesake, its origin, or the impacts it's had on the region. A group of history enthusiasts is devoting this weekend to do just that. The 2014 Mullen Road Conference starts this Friday in Missoula. Longtime Missoulian newspaper reporter Kim Brigeman is helping organize the event. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Brigeman tells us more about the road's importance. He begins by explaining his underlying interest in it.
I grew up east of Missoula around Marshall Grade, and at that time I think I was vaguely aware that the Mullen Road went through my backyard. But as I learned more and grew up more, it became clear that not only the Mullen Road, but the Indian roads, the roads to the Buffalo, and essentially the one that Meriwether Lewis followed in 1806 was also through my backyard, which it is through a lot of people's backyards in the Missoula area. And so I think that captivated me to learn more about the Mullen Road and so forth. Plus, I've had the opportunity at the Missoulian, thanks to my editors, etc., to explore Western Montana history. Well, as much as I'd like to, I guess, when the opportunity has arose.
You're a lucky guy.
I feel very lucky in that regard.
Well, we're here to talk about the Mullen Road Conference, but I guess we can't really do that without talking about its namesake, and that's John Mullen, Lieutenant John Mullen. Who was this character?
John Mullen was an interesting character, actually, and I have learned so much more about him just recently because for the first time, a full-blown biography of John Mullen is essentially hot off the presses and will be available at our conference this weekend. It's written by Keith Peterson, the Idaho State historian. He takes John's life from birth in Maryland to his death in Washington, D.C., back on the East Coast in 1909. In regards to our area here, John Mullen was the supervisor of the construction of the U.S. military wagon road. The dates are 1859 to 1862.
What kind of guy was he? Do we know much about him on a personal level?
The biography that Keith Peterson did sheds a lot of light. Supposedly, John was about 5'4". He was a pretty straight-line military guy. He was identified by one guy during the construction of his road as a monomaniac in terms of construction of his road. He had one focus, and that drove him for a good part of 10 years in his life to get this road built.
Okay, the Mullen Road, what is it? Where does it go? What was the idea behind it?
The idea behind it was to connect the highest navigable waters between the Columbia River and the Missouri River. So it was a military wagon road to deal with, at that time, pre-Civil War Indian uprisings in the Northwest. He started construction at Walla Walla, Washington, and completed the construction at Fort Benton on the headwaters of the Missouri. He made two sweeps. The first sweep was in 1859-1860, and then he got another $100,000 appropriation from Congress, even as President Lincoln was beginning his term and the Civil War was breaking out, mm-hmm. to go back and improve and in some cases change the route of the road.
Hmm. So this was very valuable to people then. I mean, if they're expending that sort of money at that time.
Yep. Territory building was big politically and just for the growth of the nation.
How big a crew was this?
You know, other people know that count better. We're talking a couple of hundred at least, mm-hmm. and it was both military, a military escort, and civilian workers, essentially. The men in the military escort had the opportunity to help with the construction of the road for more pay.
What was the payoff?
In Montana and Idaho's terms, the payoff was huge and serendipitous. The road was planned years before gold was discovered in southwestern Montana. The road construction began in 1850, for real, in 1859. There wasn't the first significant gold rush in Montana until 1862, in the latter months of the construction of the road. The road was never used hardly at all for the purpose it was built for, the military transport. In fact, it was only used once for that, and that was in the first year, 1860. But it was the interstate highway to the gold fields in Idaho and then into Grasshopper Creek, Bannock, and Alder Gulch in Montana, and then Last Chance Gulch. At the time that the road was completed in 1862, there was no such thing as Montana. The only Montana that appeared on the western landscape was a mining camp in Denver, Colorado. By May 26, 1864, we had gone from being in western Montana, gone from being Washington Territory when the road was completed to Idaho Territory in 1863 to Montana in 1864, the first time that we appeared on the map as Montana. And the road had probably unimaginable consequences in forming Montana Territory.
So if it wasn't for gold, it could have been a big bust.
In some ways, it was a big bust because the road in the stretches, especially west of Missoula, was immediately in ruin and disrepair. Nobody had left any funds to maintain it. So you couldn't get from here to Spokane very readily after the road was built, even though the road was built from Spokane to here, to Missoula.
I'm a Missoulian, Kim, and I think of Mullen Road as the road to Walmart and some beautiful residential areas west of my city here in Missoula, and there's so much more history than that.
Well, and I think that's what gets us Mullenites intrigued, is that there is so much. It's a portal to so many other things, and even the route itself, which nobody can really establish exactly where the original Mullen Road went, other than for a few rare stretches all the way between here and Walla Walla and Fort Benton. But the portals to the military history of the time, to the engineering and surveying history of the time, it's just the possibilities of where you can go if you start looking at the Mullen Road's history are endless, and I think that's what really entices us to keep looking.
Okay, let's talk about this weekend. What's happening?
Conference is an annual conference that has been at cities all along the Mullen Road, from Walla Walla to Fort Benton, with stops in between, and Spokane, Missoula once before in 2008, and in Helena. We have it back this year because 2 years ago it was in Walla Walla, and at that point it was decided instead of going willy-nilly along the road, we'd start from the western terminus in Walla Walla and work our way east. Mm-hmm. And so last year it was in Spokane, this year it's in Missoula, next year it may be in Helena, and the following year we'll get to Fort Benton and then start all over. Mm-hmm. The Mullen Road Conference has developed into a three-day thing where basically a Saturday or a Friday night reception, in our case it'll be out at the museums at Fort Missoula, based at the Military Museum. On Saturday, then, is a day-long program of speakers at Ruby's Reserve Street Inn. Saturday night, we have a banquet with the keynote speaker being Keith Peterson, the biographer of Mullen. And then on Sunday, which I to me is always the highlight of these things, is a bus tour along the Mullen Road. This year, we'll be heading east of Missoula and explore some of the neat things out there.
Back in your stomping grounds.
Back in my stomping grounds, right.
Yeah. And is this open to everybody or just, as you say, the Mullenites?
The Mullenites are the core, but man, we invite everybody. And we've segmented it to the point where we'd hope that people would pick out, you know, you don't have to come to the whole conference, but you certainly can pick out the parts that interest you and register and show up. Actually, you can show up at the door and register too. We're a fly-by-night, seat-of-the-pants operation, and so Judy Mattson, especially at the Friends of Two Rivers, have loaned us their website, tworivershistory.net. The easy way to remember to get to it is just by Googling Mullen Road Conference 2014.
Last question, pop quiz. Somebody very close to me was born and raised in Mullen, Idaho. How many statues of John Mullen are there along the road?
Ooh, pop quiz, and I'm not ready for that one. Let's see, Fort Benton, Great Falls, Deer Lodge, Drummond, two in Missoula, counting Milltown, St. Regis, and then either two or three or maybe even four in Idaho. So
that's darn good. You're a lot more specific than I was. The answer is 28.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Now, they're not all the same marble monoliths. Are all 28 of them that?
That's a good question. And I'm looking at that right now in the picture, and I don't know.
There are several in Washington that we saw on our way to Walla Walla, actually, that was a campaign basically launched here in Montana in 1916 to build those granite monuments that you see by the railroad station. Privately funded. The one out at Bonner, it was funded by W.A. Clark, the Copper King, who had built the dam at that time.
And we're talking about a statue here. This is Mullen. I take it a beard and it's not a cowboy hat necessarily.
Yeah, probably an army work hat.
Army work hat.
I don't know.
Standing there in a jaunty position with a rifle and a pistol slung in his belt. And
as far as we know, he never fired a shot in 4 years on the construction.
But he's ready for it, by God.
Right. And unfortunately, the inscriptions at the bottom of the statues say something along the lines of Captain John Mullen built the Mullen Road or Military Road. It has the wrong years, 1853 to 1855.
Oh, no.
And I never have figured that out.
Hey, Kim Brigham, and thank you so much for coming in to tell us about the Mullen Road Conference.
I appreciate it.
In now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow should also be mostly clear with highs in the mid-60s to lower 70s. For central Montana tonight, expect mostly clear skies with lows 30 to 35 degrees. And tomorrow should be sunny with highs in the 60s. For southwest Montana tonight, look for mostly clear skies and lows 25 to 35 degrees, and tomorrow should be mostly clear with highs 55 to 65 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Haypatrick.
The other day, I ran into an old friend at the grocery store. "Are you still with United Way?" she asked. "Yes," I said. "And is that what you do full-time?" she continued. I gave her the only answer that came to mind. "I'm trying to get it down to full-time," I said. That exchange got me thinking. Those of us in the nonprofit sector need to do a better job educating folks about the scope of our work, not just about how working for nonprofits is a vocation, even a calling, rather than a part-time hobby, but about the size and scope of Montana's nonprofit sector. Too often, we're seen principally as supplicants with our hands out, seeking a grant here, a donation there, and yet another silent auction item for yet another silent auction. Yes, nonprofits do ask a lot. That's how we support our organizations. But we need to do a better job talking about our overall impact in Montana, including our economic impact. Nonprofits employ 45,000 people throughout Montana, making our sector one of the largest in the state. We're bigger than the for-profit finance, insurance, real estate, and arts and entertainment sectors combined. According to the Montana Nonprofit Association, Montana's 2,000-plus charitable nonprofit employers contribute over $1.5 billion annually to our state's wage base. But our reach extends beyond our payroll. The work of nonprofits ripples out into the state's economy. People want to live, work, play, and go to school in a place that offers strong cultural, recreational, and educational opportunities, where we care for our kids and our seniors and our parks and trails and pets, where folks can find meaningful volunteer opportunities and a chance to give back. A vibrant nonprofit sector helps ensure a high quality of life, and that's good for Montana's economy. Nonprofits do an awful lot for very little. 81% of Montana nonprofits have budgets of less than $100,000. Despite these meager resources, nonprofits are mighty little engines that could, achieving results far beyond what they spend to do so. We're also extraordinarily diverse. The University of Montana is a nonprofit organization, and so are small private schools. Missoula Children's Theater is a nonprofit, and so is that edgy dance troupe you went to see the other night. The Montana Food Bank Network is a statewide nonprofit serving small local food pantries, also nonprofit, throughout Montana. But here's what we have in common. We all do work that government and the business sector can't do, won't do, or doesn't do, but in which we all have a stake. Through nonprofits, the public trust is put in private hands. What would Montana be without art and music and programs for our kids? Would we really attract and keep businesses and professionals without the quality of life that so many nonprofits work to protect and improve? People sometimes complain to me about how often they're asked for donations. I get it. I'm overwhelmed too, whether it's by United Way grant seekers whose proposals we're not able to fully fund, or whether it's the endless stream of ask letters that flood my home mailbox. As a recent New York Times article pointed out, government funding has not returned to pre-recession levels, philanthropic dollars are limited, and demand for critical services has climbed dramatically. For many nonprofits, especially those that provide the very basics to poor people, it's as if the recession never ended. In general, nonprofits are accustomed to doing lots with less, but most of us have accepted the fact that we're going to be dealing with stagnant revenues and higher demands for years to come, even as the economy creeps back. I, too, could do with a lot fewer dinners and auctions, but the fact is that they raise a lot of money, and we need a lot of money to continue providing vital and beneficial services to our state. I'll end tonight by trying to bust a Missoula nonprofit myth and by asking you to support a unique Missoula giving event. First, the myth. More than a decade ago, a single sentence in Forbes magazine stated that Missoula has more nonprofits per capita than any other city in the country. Years later, I still hear that. Here's why it's incorrect. First, you have to subtract the chapters of Missoula-based regional, national, or international organizations that exist all over the country but are registered in Missoula. The Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation alone has hundreds. They're registered here, but they don't operate here. Second, for whatever reason, people in Missoula have created lots of nonprofits. Frankly, it's too easy to do. But a great many of those organizations never get off the ground. They don't hire staff or raise enough money to really accomplish anything, but they're still registered with the Secretary of State. Counting only the nonprofits that pay wages and file tax returns gives us the much more manageable number of 253. It's a lot, but it's not breathtaking. Of our state's 7 population centers, Helena has the highest density of nonprofits. So there. Finally, here's the unique Missoula giving event. On May 6th, the Missoula Community Foundation is sponsoring Give Local Missoula, a 24-hour online giving event. Part of a national event called Give Local America, Give Local Missoula is designed to engage first-time donors and younger donors while raising the profile of charitable giving. Gifts made during Give Local Missoula will be matched by a $10,000 stretch pool. I'm Susan Hay Patrick, CEO of United Way of Missoula County. Thanks for listening.
Susan Hay Patrick is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.